Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. I'd like to welcome our audience live here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Steve Machtinger, the speaker tonight, along with his quintet, the London Quintet, to perform on the Mozart Quintet, the G Quintet, from 1787, right? Did I have that right? No, I didn't get that right. Close. Steve's has performed here before and lectured here before, and his love is the ideas that are behind the Mozart music that he created and composed, and so he likes to explain the ideas and perform and explain the ideas and perform. And tonight, as those of you who mentioned the new word that you may all have all learned on Masonic semiotics, the ideas in that, as an idea behind services that were done in the Masonic rituals that Mozart used as a basis. But Steve has also discovered, since we described this, that this also relates to Pericles' funeral oration, and we're going to be talking, he is going to be talking about that as well. So, Steve Machtinger.
Thank you, George. The goal of the presentation tonight is to try to show you how Mozart used the signs and symbols of the Freemasons to convey philosophical messages in his music. And we're going to be focusing specifically on the third movement of his quintet for strings in G minor, Kürschel 387. In particular, I want to explore how this work sheds light on what Mozart meant in a letter he wrote to his father around the same time. This is the spring of 1787. We talked about this letter in the previous two lectures because this letter is generally regarded to state Mozart's philosophical views about death, immortality, philosophy, the meaning of life. And he wrote in this letter that death is our ultimate purpose, our best friend, and the key to our happiness. And I've been disturbed by this statement. It doesn't feel like Mozart. I don't think he really meant that. Mozart acknowledged in his other letters that he wished he was better at expressing his views in words, but what he really knew he could do is express his views in music. And so we've turned to a piece that he wrote around this same time. This was a very special period in his life when he had just completed the Marriage of Figaro and done had a very successful presentation of it in Prague. And he had been awarded the commission to do a new opera, and he was waiting for the libretto, and he wrote these he wrote this quintet and another equally great quintet in C major. The new opera, of course, was Don Giovanni, and it's the only opera in Mozart in which somebody dies on stage. And in fact, two people die on stage. One is the person Don Giovanni kills, and the other is the stone statue that comes back to get him. What I'd like to do now is hear a couple of excerpts from the first movement, because what we've learned and what we've discussed in previous lectures is that in writing this piece, Mozart actually wrote a Greek epic, an epic tragedy of an ancient hero, and we can see we've talked about the symbols that he used in describing the story of this Greek hero. In the first movement, we're introduced to the hero. And there's a motif played by the first violin accompanied by a very energetic pounding accompaniment in the other two instruments. And we will hear that now, just a few bars from the first movement at the very beginning, the hero motif. In the next part of the first movement, the hero meets his nemesis, which we call the angel of death. And it's a very Mozart did something very unusual in introducing the second theme. He introduced it in the same key as the first theme, which is unheard of and unprecedented in this form of music. He also keeps using these same pulsating eighth notes, and there's an implication that the angel of death represents a drive inside of Mozart, inside of the hero. And we'll hear just a couple of bars of the angel of death motif. And since the hero is a hero, he has to go on a dangerous adventure. And in this case, we'll hear the hero's adventure beginning at the development section. And he confronts the angel of death and comes to a complete stop. And we'll hear that passage now. So that driving rhythm you hear over and over again is the hero motif. And I point that out to you now because it shows up at a very interesting moment in the third movement that we'll be focusing on. So at the end of the first movement, the hero confronts the angel of death. He dies a glorious death. His soul leaves his body. The second movement, which we discussed in the last lecture in January, the hero's spirit ascends to another place and meets up with the deity, and there's a confrontation over the destination and fate of the hero's soul. For this third movement, we return to Earth, and we have a community and a gathering of the survivors and the mourners who have gathered together to remember the hero's great deeds. We don't have any hints in this movement, as we didn't in any of the others, of extra musical content, at least nothing explicit. What we have is a marking that it's adagio non troppo, which means it's slow, but not too slow. There's an instruction that all of us play with mutes on our instruments. A mute is sort of like it's a mechanical device like a clothespin, which pinches the bridge and makes the sound a lot quieter. Mozart reserved the mute for his most special moments. Examples are the slow movement from his 21st piano concerto and the farewell trio from Così fan tutte. Both of those were turned into the soundtracks to major movies. So people have recognized that concertino, which is the Italian for put on your mute, means something special to Mozart. To my knowledge, this particular movement has not yet been made into a movie, but if there are any film directors out there, we'd be very happy to collaborate with you. This movement is in E-flat, which is the key that's often associated with Mozart's music that's inspired by his membership in the Freemasons. The number three is magical for the Freemasons. And it so happens that the key of E-flat has three flats. The magic flute, which is an allegory of the Freemasonry movement, it also has as its dominant key E-flat. And his most famous explicitly Masonic funeral music is in C minor, which also has three flats. So it's not only the key signature, but it's the stately solemnity of this movement that evokes a very serious memorial service. And if you're familiar with the magic flute, it might evoke the chorus of the priests that opens the second act of the magic flute. We're gonna play the first, just the very beginning of the of this section, and we'll be playing just a few excerpts for you, and then we'll play the entire movement. The whole movement is about 7 or 8 minutes. So here are the first 4 bars, which evoke the chorale and the gathering of the Masonic mourners for the hero. If this were a film, that would be the broad pan of the whole chorus. And the next few bars would be close-ups of the individual mourners. So you'll hear the first violin and the cello alternating as though they were quietly meditating on their own private sorrow. The structure of this slow movement is important to the how Mozart conveys the meaning. In a classical slow movement, it's typically divided into two halves, and this follows that pattern. It's called a binary structure. So unlike the first movement, which has a development section, unlike the second movement, the minuet, which has a contrasting trio section, this is just two halves. Each half has three parts, and the three parts are stated, and then they're repeated again. They're not exactly the same. In the second half, the key changes, and there's some interesting things Mozart does with transitional passages, which we'll point out, and then there's a brief coda or conclusion at the very end. The transitional passage after the first section is significant because it contains three attacks, which are called sforzandi. They're accents. And each one of these attacks is like a blow to the hero. And taken together, the three strikes symbolize the death of the hero. This has a very important Masonic significance. Mozart joined the Freemasons in 1784, and he was elevated to the level of Master Mason in the spring of 85. Now, the elevation to the Master Mason category was a big deal with the Masons. And in order to become a Master Mason, Mozart had to undergo a special ritual which included his own symbolic murder. I was able to get a copy of the original manuscript document for a lodge very close to where Mozart was inducted into the Freemasons as a master mason, and was able to have it translated. It's never appeared in English, but it had some very interesting things in it. Mozart was brought into a large hall blindfolded. The blindfolds were removed, and he saw around him candles and images of skulls and crossbones, and people started talking to him about don't be afraid of death. He was then brought in front of the master of the lodge, who had a hammer, and the master of the lodge struck him on the forehead with a hammer rather gently twice, and then a little less gently the third time. And the third time, and he'd been instructed on how this was going to go, but he'd never seen it. It couldn't have been a complete shock. He was enacted the death of the original Master Mason. He fell to the ground, and his body was covered with a bloody cloth. He was then brought to stand up, and he was told the story, the mythical story about the legendary hero of the Masons, supposed architect of Solomon's Temple, an architect named Hiram Abiff. And in the story, Hiram is attacked by three journeyman Masons. That's the second level of Mason, the one that Mozart was being promoted from. And they were trying to get Hiram to tell him the secret word that would allow them to get paid at the scale of the master Mason. So this whole thing was really a big fight over union scale and when it's somebody trying to get paid at a higher grade level. But anyway, that's the story. He refuses, of course, to give up the sacred word that would allow the master Mason to get paid, or the journeyman to get paid at a higher rate than he was entitled to. And each of the three ruffians who had arrested him then struck him, and the third time it was severe enough that he was killed. And the script actually reads like this. It says, "To be sure, the blows the two of the conspirators inflicted upon him were not deadly, but the third one hit his forehead so violently that he fell to the ground dead." And the story goes on. His body was later found by a search party of nine masters. And then the candidate is told that the allegory is supposed to remind him of his sacred duties to his fellow Masons. And the script says, "Among other things, the allegory has as its purpose the shaming of those who are unholy and who fear death. Cowardly fear of death often makes us betray our holiest duties." Now, the Masons didn't just make this up. They got this from various sources. And the most interesting and earliest source that I was able to find was in the Iliad, where the great Greek hero and best friend of Achilles, whose name is Patroclus, is sent out onto the battlefield, and he is stopped by the gods, and three different Trojan warriors strike him, and the third strike is by the great Trojan hero Hector, and the third blow is the fatal one, and he goes to the ground. So this story has its roots in Homer's Iliad and in the stories of Greek mythology. The pattern of three blows is repeated in various sections of this movement to remind us of the death of the hero and the reason that we're having this memorial service. And when we play it through, maybe you can listen for how many times, how many groups of three you hear, and maybe there will be a prize for whoever guesses the number of strikeouts. So we're going to play the transitional section, which is the first time in the movement that announces this repetition of three strikes.
Thank you.
introduce the members of the band. We have Anna Washburn on first violin, Midori Nakayama on second violin, and Oscar Hasbun on second viola, Luella Hasbun on cello. Oscar and Luella are colleagues of mine in the Marin Symphony. So after the first section, which we've just been discussing, the first section is basically the orientation in the Masonic Masonic Lodge, the gathering together of the mourners. The second and third sections follow the pattern of the ancient Greek funeral oration. I learned this by remembering about a book I had read many years ago called Lincoln at Gettysburg by Gary Wills. And in that book, Professor Wills shows how Lincoln modeled the Gettysburg Address on the ancient funeral oration of Pericles after a great battle mourning for the dead. And I found that this piece by Mozart, of course, many years before the Gettysburg Address, used the same pattern. The Greek funeral oration has two basic parts to it. There's the part that mourns the dead hero. It talks about his noble deeds. That's called the epinesis. And then the second part of it speaks to the survivors and talks about what we as survivors can learn from the hero's noble death, and it tries to inspire us to live lives worthy of the hero. That's called the perinesis. And if you read through the Gettysburg Address, you'll see that those are the two sections. You'll understand it better if you read Gary Wills' book. But it's remarkable how closely this quintet parallels that format. So section two, which is the first of these two sections of the Greek funeral oration, invokes the hero's noble death in many ways. First, we have the first violin playing a descending scale that's very similar to the Angel of Death motif we heard in the first movement. It's in the dark key of B flat minor, and if you were reading that on a staff, that you would have to negotiate five flats in your key. It's repeated later in six flats. The second time. The melody is accompanied by pulsating eighth notes, which we heard in the first movement, which reminds us of the energy that the hero brought to bear on everything he did. The theme is repeated three times, and each time at the top of the melody, we have a sforzando accent. And so those three, if you're counting strikeouts, that'll count as one strikeout. And most interestingly, we hear a murmur in the second viola, which is the same rhythm phrasing as the hero motif that we heard in the first movement. So if you take all this together, we have a section that is mourning the death of the hero and recounting his glorious deeds. We'll play just a few bars of that for you now. So after a brief transition, we get to the final section, the perinesis, which is the third section of the first part of the third movement of Mozart's quintet. And it's suddenly the tone changes and the mood brightens with a sudden shift to a major key, B flat major. and the accompaniment changes. Instead of these pounding 16th notes, we get a kind of a jaunty, dancing offbeat. The violin and the viola launch into a beautiful duet, very harmonious. But at the same time, the joy that's evoked by these elements is contradicted and diffused by darker emotions. The melody is still, it's a variation on the same descending theme we had in the second section. It's broken into pairs of slurred notes. Each one of these slurred notes was generally known as a symbol of a sigh. And the top of the melody is accented three times, so we have another strikeout symbolizing the death of the hero. The contradiction between these two elements, or kinds of elements, was described by one author as smiling through tears, which is a very apt way of describing these very delicate moments in the music of Mozart. So we'll just play a few bars from the beginning of the third theme. So then we get to the what's called the recapitulation. It goes right back to the beginning of the piece, and the first section is played exactly as it was. There's a transition to the second section, but as I mentioned, in a different key. And then the most extraordinary moment in the whole movement is the transition from the second section to the third section when we play it the second time. The second section, as you recall, is the section about the hero and grieving for the hero and the loss, and the third section is the happier section where we're getting on with our lives. In the first part, Mozart had a transition between those two, which lasted about one bar. The second time, he extends it to three bars and extends it with the most unusual harmonic progressions to the point where you don't really know when it's going to end. And it symbolizes Mozart's difficulty in letting go of the grief that's expressed in the second section. So we'll play this exquisite part for you, and then you'll hear how he extends it through this unusual harmonic progression. Okay, that was the transition from the second section to the third section in the second half and of the movement. After that, it continues according to its standard format, and then there's a wonderful coda which functions kind of like a benediction. And Mozart inserts a variation of the four-note phrase that we heard near the beginning where people are meditating on their own loss. But this time he tweaks the melody just enough, and he, instead of just four notes, it resolves into the next note. And if Mozart had played this as he did with his friends, they probably would have noticed that this is the same tune that he used for the fugue of the first quartet that he dedicated to Haydn, who was his revered friend and a fellow Mason. So this is Mozart kind of putting his own stamp on the benediction that's sending the mourners back out into their lives. So we'll play just the very end for you now. Play the whole thing through? Okay. So we'll now play the third movement of Mozart's G minor quintet, Kochel 516. Thank you. So just a couple of conclusions. So in this third movement, we've gathered together, we've recounted the glorious deeds of the fallen hero, we've acknowledged his noble sacrifice, we've been inspired to live better lives that are worthy of his memory. And I guess the lesson is that in terms of happiness and what Mozart might have meant in his earlier in his letter we discussed earlier, according to this movement, our happiness comes from the meaning we derive from having known the hero and from telling his inspiring story. But there's reason to believe that Mozart was not completely satisfied with this conclusion, that in the very next moment of this quintet, he plunges us into the darkest depths of lamentation and despair with a sudden, sullen G minor chord. But we'll have to wait to discuss that in our next lecture.
Online and radio audiences that they're listening.
would our Music Matters series be without Mozart and Machtinger? That's my question. So, who would like to ask the first question besides me? Good.
I'm curious if the audience would have understood the exegesis that you gave us.
Mozart wrote a letter that where he said that he hoped his music could be understood at different levels, and he understood that there were people who were skilled and experts, and that there were other people who just enjoyed music. So maybe only a few people would have understood, maybe nobody, but some of it clearly would be understood. The descending chromatic scales were very well known in terms of what they represented. People probably would have intuited that there was he was evoking a Masonic chorus. Some of the more esoteric things, I don't know. And some of the things I've said, I've found in some of the literature, but other things I haven't found. So no, I can't claim that my interpretation has been accepted, but I think there's a movement now to try to get past the idea that music was just absolute music and would be enjoyed only for its own sake. In the past generation, there was, for 100 years, it was people weren't allowed to talk about what music was about. That was not acceptable. And beginning around 1970, that started to change. And so now people are learning more and writing more. And the main way they do it is they'll go to one of his operas and they'll see what kind of instrumental music accompanied what kind of text. And then they'll see that there was that same phrase in an opera, in his instrumental music. And if you piece these things together, you can find things that were going on with Mozart that nobody's really talked about for over 100 years.
I'm wondering if you would make again the reference to Haydn at the end of the movement that kind of went by a little fast, and say again what the reference is.
Mozart worked very hard at one. First of all, Haydn was both before Mozart and after Mozart. He was a generation older than Mozart, and then he lived a generation longer than Mozart. And so they had a very unusual and wonderful relationship where they learned from each other. And early on, Mozart learned a lot about the writing of string quartets from Haydn. So much so that when he took a leap forward in his own development as a composer by writing 6 quartets dedicated to Haydn. And he wrote a very elaborate, formal introduction to these about how he had labored so hard on them, and he was turning his children over to a new master. And the first of those quartets, Kirchel 387, ended in a bravura fugue, and the theme to that fugue is note for note the theme that he ends this piece on. He had written that quartet 2 years earlier, and whether he was doing it consciously or subconsciously, we don't know. And I would never presume to guess what was going on inside Mozart's head. All we can do is look at the evidence and try to make connections and draw conclusions. But I thought it was interesting that he chose to end this particular piece with the same motto that he had ended his first quartet dedicated to Haydn, who was a fellow Mason and his mentor.
It's interesting to me.
Oh, we need a microphone. And George has given, okay.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be back and hear the quartet again. And thank you for educating us so well. Death was so important to Mozart and so important to the Masonic ritual. And did any of them come to any aid at the end? I mean, he died and was put in a terrible grave for anybody, thrown in a grave. And even the wife, I mean, did the Masonics come through for them at all?
They did come through. There's a myth that Mozart died in poverty and was thrown into a grave that was not worthy of him. The reality, Mozart was insolvent, but he was not poor. His cash flow was very uneven. He lived among the nobility, and he wanted to live like the nobility. And unfortunately, there was a war that went on in 1787 against Turkey, and the nobility fled Vienna, and it reduced his income. He had to move to more modest quarters. And unfortunately, just as he was got sick and died, he had just done the magic flute and may well have recovered financially. The reason he was buried in a mass grave, but that was part of an enlightened a program on the part of Joseph II, who wanted to, he didn't like the idea that the nobility had better funerals than other people. And the people were going to town on these elaborate funerals, and so this custom was introduced that people would all have a similar funeral, we would stop making a big fuss out of it. And so he was buried as he would have wanted to be. The Masons then did a fundraiser, and they raised money for Mozart's widow, and they said some very nice things. And he was a Mason from the time he joined until the end of his life. They were very important to him socially, spiritually, and there's every reason to think that it was reciprocated. In the mid-1780s, that was the place where the intellectuals and the thinkers, and even though the Catholic Church was supposed to Masonry, many of the Masons were Catholics. At the end of 1785, the emperor had started regulating them, and that was the beginning of the end. They dispersed, and a lot of the lodges closed. A lot of people quit, but Mozart stayed on. He had most of his meals there. He was very social. Many of his dear friends were there. His main creditor was a Mason, and his favorite clarinet player, and he wrote a lot of music for them, and it was an important part of his life.
Bravo, Steve, and all. You started to touch on this. How prevalent was participation in the Masons among the populace of Vienna during Mozart's time?
Among the upper middle class and nobility, it was very popular. It just spread like wildfire. Especially after, in 1780, Empress Maria Theresa died. She had been very hostile to the Freemasons. And her son, who had been co-regent, Joseph II, became sole emperor, and he relaxed things. And so from 1780 to 1785, it grew exponentially, and everybody who was anybody was a member of the Masons. There were many lodges. And it wasn't just in Vienna, it was in Prague and throughout the empire. But as I mentioned, starting in December of 1785, it started to decline. Part of this was there were a lot of other secret societies that started developing, that the Rosicrucians, a group called the Asian Brethren, the Illuminati. This was a time of ferment, and the monarch was not comfortable. His sister was someone named Marie Antoinette, and this was 1787, and he wasn't completely comfortable with all these secret societies, so he tried to get a handle on it, and they became less important to the culture after that.
Next question.
Thank you all first for a wonderful lecture and wonderful, beautiful playing. But I was really fascinated by the description of Mozart's own initiation rite, because it sounded like just the stage descriptions for a scene in The Magic Flute. And so was that meant to be secret? I mean, because in a way, that if anyone had read that document and saw The Magic Flute, the secret was out.
It was semi-secret. It was what we call an open secret.
Mm-hmm.
And people were very open about their membership.
Yeah.
They said it was secret. It gave it some cachet. But there were no repercussions for The Magic Flute. The Magic Flute is now understood to be a Masonic allegory. But it wasn't that secret.
Okay. Thank you.
Steve, where did you? I mean, what kind of clues did you follow to connect the music to these things? I mean, what things made you bring it to the Masons? It's kind of clear. What kind of things brought you to the Greek funeral thing?
Well, I actually started. I got interested in the Greek in the Iliad from a lecture I attended at the Commonwealth Club. I hope you weren't prompting me for a plug, but. we came and heard Stephen Mitchell read from his new translation of the Iliad, and that was quite stunning. And so I've been reading it for pleasure lately. I don't know where the three strikes. It just I think I was just amazed when I saw the ritual, and I was excited because this was. It's hard to discover new things about Mozart. It's these people in writing, there are literally thousands of books about Mozart. And this ritual ceremony was written about and partly quoted and partly translated. It was quoted and partly translated in a wonderful biography by a writer named Brown Barons. But there was only a very small portion that was revealed there, and I wanted to know more about his. I want to know everything about his Masonic membership and what the rituals were, because everybody said that his letter to his father, which is what started all this, was based on the teachings of the Masons. And so I wrote away to the library that had in Prague that had the manuscript, and they sent it to me. And it was actually Oscar and Luella's daughter is a linguist. And one of her friends was an expert in translating old German manuscripts. And so he translated it for me, and then we compared it to the translation in Brown Barons' book. And I think just imagining Mozart, being clobbered over the head in front of a group of people and lying down under a bloody cloth and being lectured to, and then him bringing his father and Haydn in with him and then witnessing this. It's just amazing to imagine, and it struck me that this must have been a very powerful experience for him. And I mean, everyone knows that the Magic Flute has these three chords in the overture, and the number three appears all the time with there's the three boys and the three ladies and the three trials, and so that was well known. It's remarkable. It's the key breakthrough conceptually was imagining this work as an epic about a hero. And I've just been amazed at how every bit of it has fallen into place with that paradigm. And I don't know if Mozart actually had this in mind, but it works.
Could you talk a little about the origin of the Masons? Was it primarily religious? And also, how prevalent are they today?
Well, their origins are shrouded in secrecy on purpose. And so there's been a lot of nonsense written about the Masons. And people say that they emerged from the Knights Templar, which was from the Crusades. The Masons say that they came from the stonemasons who built the great cathedrals of France. But in its modern incarnation, modern masonry began in 1717 in an ale house in London. And members of four different lodges, drinking clubs and eating clubs, got together and merged. And a few years later, they had a constitution written by a French-born Anglican named de Goulier. And the idea was it would be a way for people to talk to each other and debate the ideas of the day without being afraid of intervention by the state or the church. A lot of the members had come out of the Royal Society. Newton was not a Mason, but he was part of that whole group. And this was a very distinguished group of Englishmen who had been traumatized by the Wars of England, the Wars of the Crown, where the Regicide and the English Revolution. And then in Germany, there had also been a trauma of the 30 Years' War, where people had, the Protestants and the Catholics, just devastated Europe. There's an interesting book called Global Crisis, which connects all these revolutions of the 1600s to climate change. And there was a little ice age, and the crops were bad, and there were revolutions. And there are a lot of things that were going on. But the people in London decided that they needed a protected place to talk about these new ideas, which were, this was a time where Newton and Galileo and Copernicus and Kepler were coming up with new ideas about how the world worked, which the church was very threatened by. And so it caught on in England. It was very prevalent in Scotland. By 1740, there was a lodge in Vienna. It became very popular in the Habsburg territories, especially in the 1780s. It's still a major force. There are at least hundreds of thousands of Freemasons today. They don't regard themselves as a religious society. It's a fraternal, charitable, social group in its origins. There have always been fringe groups, but it's still very solid. And I visited the Freemason Lodge in London recently, and it's a beautiful hall, and it's still inspiring to a lot of people.
Now, the Masons have a national headquarters in the United States in Washington, D.C., and it's in Alexandria, right outside, and the building is designed to look like the Alexandria Lighthouse. I mean, it's a reproduction of that in Alexandria, Virginia, and it's dedicated to George Washington. They have like a 20-foot statue of George Washington there because he was a Mason. It was basically the same time. A lot of the leaders of the American Revolution were Masons as well. And so they're not quite as many millions of people afraid that the Masons are running the world behind the scenes anymore as they used to. But next question. We have time for maybe two more questions.
Are women still excluded from the Masons? And I remember in the eighth grade, I was a rainbow girl, which had something to do with them. But anyway, what's the status of women in Masons now?
There's much progress yet to be made.
That's the most diplomatic answer on that question I've ever heard, Steve. Okay, one last question.
If I might just interject some clarification on that last question, there are actually Masonic lodges around the world that are women only, and there are also lodges that are women and men. In the United States, there are very few, but in France, they are quite common, and elsewhere in Europe. And we are, I'm a Mason, but there is a general trend towards détente, and perhaps eventually full acceptance. And there are actually about 4 million Masons in the U.S., if that helps at all. Pardon me?
How generous are
they? For any organization that's been around for 4 centuries,
All right. Anyone have one last question about Pericles? Okay, great. Well, thank you very, very much, Steve.
And the London Quintet, of course. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 113 years of, should I say, enlightened or illuminated discussion. Thank you very much.